call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight on Wednesday, March 21st. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. First item on our agenda is the minutes from the Monday, March 19th meeting. Please take a moment to review them. And then Senator Vickerman, there are no correction, moves adoption of the minutes from March 19th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. He's not here. I know they had to go and vote. People are having to vote on other bills here. Senator Limmer is here, or is what? Senator Chaudhry here? I'll just go down the list. No, okay. Then Senator Limmer, number four on the agenda, Senate File 1242. We have the second engrossment before us. Senator Limmer, this bill went to what other committee before?
Madam Chair, this bill, Senate File 1242, just came from Judiciary Committee, where it was passed yesterday.
Beg pardon?
It was passed yesterday in Judiciary Committee, and upon request of this committee, it's now before you.
And the sections of the bill that are in the jurisdiction of this committee are, if you would point them out to us, please, Senator Limmer.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure what sections you're interested in. Perhaps counsel can give us a better reference to that.
Mr. Bodden, what brings this bill here?
Madam Chair and members, it makes a number of changes to the state procurement statutes in Chapter 16A. So you'll see that in N16B and 16C. That's basically the first three sections of the bill. Then there's some additional cross-references. These basically affect how the Commissioner of Administration administers state procurement.
Okay, so we're interested in the administration of procurements. If you would speak to that, those issues, please.
Madam Chair, just as a very brief review, you may recall that the legislative auditor raised questions about MNCOR's definitions and use of the term surplus property, their relationship to the Minnesota Correctional Educational Foundation, and how they define surplus product and surplus property and what policies they have regarding that. Commissioner Dennis Benson is here to review the concerns that this committee may have regarding this particular bill. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Assistant Commissioner Benson from the Department of Corrections.
Senator Limmer and your witness, please identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And as Senator Limmer indicated, the bill before you today is kind of a compilation of a couple different things. The primary focus is in response to a legislative auditor's report that was completed last early summer that addressed some shortcomings with respect to issues around MNCOR, our prison industry program, and there are a couple of other things that we've included in this bill that are housekeeping in nature. One being the access to deed database. This was just amended onto the MNCOR bill in committee yesterday. And basically what this does is it gives the Department of Corrections access to the deed database. And we're interested in this because prisoner reentry is a initiative of the Department of Corrections, and we're really looking to get a feel for how well the department is doing with respect to placing offenders that participate not only in MnCOR but in our other programs as well, and follow them once they are released and in the community. So that is a piece of the bill as well. In addition to that, I'll very quickly go through some of the changes that were made to a couple of different statutes here that pertain to prison industry. We passed out a one-pager that succinctly, I think, captures what we're trying to accomplish here. 16A.72, subdivision 7 and 8, refers to our canteen proceeds. Canteen is similar to the store that offenders buy their products from on a weekly basis. We have centralized canteen operations, and we put it under the operation of prison industry. This provision just simply indicates that the canteen funds will go into the MnCOR revolving account or the MnCOR checkbook. I would also add that we work very closely with Department of Administration on many of these changes as they do pertain to statutes that govern their operation.
And are they in support of the changes that were made?
Madam Chair and members, yes, they are. And I believe someone may be here
see
available
Mr. Allen here.
To offer testimony if necessary. Subdivision or MS 16B181, subdivision 2B, D, and E really refers to the old state use law. We used to have a state use law that was in effect that this provision eliminates a requirement that state agencies must purchase from MnCOR. We operate MnCOR like any other business. We want to go out there and compete, and we believe that we're able to do that now. MnCOR went from a $6 million subsidy about 6-7 years ago to break even, so the taxpayers are no longer subsidizing prison industry, and we just believe that this is the right thing to do. State agencies should be able to receive competitive bids from vendors, and if they can save additional dollars, we think that's a good thing. 16C.23 subdivision 2 is surplus property. This is one of those issues that was raised in the legislative auditor's report. We were criticized probably appropriately in terms of how we discarded or got rid of surplus product. Surplus product and surplus property are two different things. The statute wasn't real clear on how you get rid of surplus product. So this subdivision clarifies that and cleans it up so that we distinguish the difference between property and product. I'm going to skip the next one for just a quick moment here, 241. Go to 241.27, establishment of Minnesota Correctional Industries Revolving Fund. Basically, this is some cleanup language. As those of you know that are familiar with education, vocational is a terminology that is not used like it used to be, so we've substituted educational or vocational for educational. This subdivision also indicates how the MnCOR funds may be used. And one thing that we would like to use some MnCOR funds for is education, training, and work development skills. And it's laid out in that piece of the bill. 241.27, subdivision 3 and 4, disbursement from the fund. Basically, what this piece of the bill does is indicates how much money we believe we need to have to operate a $40 million a year business at any given time. Basically, based on the previous 12 months of business, in terms of what the operational dollar amount is, we believe we need a six months worth of dollars in our revolving fund to make sure that we can keep the business solvent. And then MS 241.278, from time to time, we've farmed some work out to county jails, particularly, I believe, was Ramsey County Workhouse, did some piecework for us. And this subdivision simply indicates how we get those dollars, or allows us to get those dollars back into the MinCor revolving account. And then there's another housekeeping piece that was also alluded to in the legislative auditor's report, and that had to do with our Community Corrections Act counties. And existing statutory language requires that CCA counties submit financial status reports on or before the end of each calendar quarter. This time frame isn't sufficient for counties to compile accurate information, and basically this provision simply changes that from the end of the quarter to within 60 days of the end of the quarter. Just gives a little bit of a comfort period. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, on the last page of the bill are the repealers. 241.021 is the essence of the state use language. Again, we no longer use that, so we believe that that can be repealed. And then also another housekeeping piece, 241.85, was an old piece of legislation from 1999, actually 98 session, I believe, that required an educational report, and we're no longer doing that. So in a nutshell, that's what's included in this bill. Again, we've worked closely with the Department of Administration. We have got some good, I think, advice from the legislative auditor's report in terms of what we might want to look at and include to try to get us more consistent with running a business inside of government.
Thank you. I'd like to return to Section 5, to the revolving fund itself, and the new language. And I want to understand what your purpose is here, that it says now that services and the commodities that are used and held for resale are not subject to competitive bidding, but are subject to all other provisions unless otherwise identified. What does that mean?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Rich Schoenthalter, our CFO for MinCor, respond to that. I think he can do it more succinctly than I can.
Madam Chair, my name is Rich Schoenthalter. I'm a CFO for MinCor, Madam Chair and Committee. That relates to the right now we are have an exemption from the formal bidding process for items that we make for resale, for raw material that we buy for resale. That just adds in the language basically some services, because we do contract out once in a while with services that we need to react fast to on our bidding process. Usually what we do is we still follow a lot of the parameters that are under the admin with the three, but the actual formal process has been exempted for us for those purchases only related to our resale or what we manufacture in the process. So it's kind of clarifying some of that language as the legislative auditor has applied to or looked at some of that area.
Does that work? Yeah, what we're concerned about is the language unless otherwise identified. What do you need that for? I mean, are you cross-referencing exemptions? Mr. Bodern, could you
Madam Chair and members,
identify the difficulty here?
On page 5, line 1, it's just, I think it may be intended to be merely technical, but it'd be worth confirming it. The phrase there says the acquisition is subject to all other provisions of Chapter 16B and 16C unless otherwise identified. And that could be intended to pick up other cross-references in that section unless somebody else is identifying which ones you're not subject to. I'm not certain of that.
No,
we
have only
some confusion.
Madam Chair and committee members, and I see the confusion. We've only identified the exemption to the 16C, the formal bidding. This would, again, like you said, pick up any other cross-references, but we have no other cross-references to that in here.
So is that phrase necessary?
That phrase would not be necessary. We could eliminate that.
Senator Lurie. moves on page 5, line 1, to strike
the new language.
The comma.
New language. The new language.
The new language.
So moved.
You've heard Senator Lurie's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Are there any other questions on this bill? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to comment either in support or in opposition? I guess I would like to hear just briefly from a representative from the Department of Administration. Mr. Allen, if you would identify yourself for the committee. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Make a general comment about the bill, that would be sufficient.
Certainly. My name's Kent Allen. I'm the director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. I can speak to this very briefly. Commissioner Benson is absolutely correct in saying that he and his staff have worked closely with administration on this language. There are two aspects of this that really impact our program, and I'll mention each of those briefly and say why it seems like a good idea from my perspective. This actually is the first case in my experience when somebody who has a preference built into state procurement laws has come to me and said, we don't need that advantage anymore. So I think that's really a tribute to the staff in the Department of Corrections and MinCorps, that they've taken this previously subsidized organization to the point of self-sufficiency and have come to the state procurement office and said, we're happy to repeal these advantages that had been in the law for us previously. The second piece ties to the surplus property disposition, and I think Commissioner Benson's correct in saying that there is a difference between what we would normally handle in administration as surplus property, which is used state equipment, vehicles, desks, computers, and what a business that has to operate as a business produces for sale. And the law as it's being amended recognizes that MinCorps is having to operate as a business and can make better decisions than admin can with respect to how to market and price those goods that they manufacture for sale. So for those reasons, we're fully supportive of these changes.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Is there further discussion of this bill? Seeing none, Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 1242 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Memmer. Senator Prettner-Solon, I think, has a pressing commitment here. Take her next, and then Senator Pappas has a witness who has a time constraint, so we'll take that bill next and then go back to the top of the agenda. Senator Prettner-Solon brings us Senate File 1974. Welcome to the committee, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and I wish to take just a brief period of time with you at this point. This bill was actually brought to me about a week ago, and it changed one word, firefighters, in the paragraph, and I looked at it and said, oh, this is a simple bill, and the firefighters are my friends, and sure, I'd be glad to carry this bill. Well, it turns out today I got a ton of phone calls, and it turns out to be a bit controversial. Actually, what the bill does is it adds to the list of essential employees within the state the title firefighters. As far as we can determine, this applies only to firefighters at the Air National Guard. What I said I would do is to have a brief hearing for informational purposes only to get this out, and then that we would lay it over for the interim and allow the people on either side of it to meet and see if they can come to some agreement on this. And I have with me today General Tim Casalter from the Air National Guard.
General Casalter, welcome back. And we are pleased to hear your testimony. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Brigadier General Tim Casalter. I'm Assistant to the Adjutant General for the Department of Military Affairs. The interest that the National Guard has in this really is because of the impact it has on the firefighters at the Air National Guard base in Duluth. And it's sensitive, and why it's controversial is because we're dealing with something that's near and dear to most Minnesotans, and that's their ability to strike. And this would limit that ability, which I'll go back a little bit in history. If we go back to the last state strike, which was in 02, which is post-September 11th, and I had the privilege of being the commander at the Duluth Air National Guard Base at that time. And when we came across the fact that we were going to have a strike, we anticipated or expected that the firefighters were essential employees. And when we determined that they were not, I was put in a position of essentially mobilizing guard members to provide that capability. And we had our firefighters basically picketing the base, and we had people coming across that line, which really becomes very contentious. And I had the challenge of dealing with and trying to maintain calm amongst all the employees, because as I'm sure we've all experienced, there are challenges whenever we have a labor dispute. The necessity for this arises from the fact that the Air National Guard provides the sole crash fire rescue capability for the Duluth International Airport, and it provides the only sole crash fire capability for the alert commitment, which Duluth maintains. And they also provide the first responder capability for the airport. So if you are flying into Duluth or you have a medical emergency at the airport, it's one of those Air National Guard firefighters that will be the first responders or deal with that emergency. So it becomes a pretty critical task. And if they're not essential employees and they're allowed to strike, because of the nature of, you might say, the post-911 world, I was able to mobilize people, I would not have that capability in the future. So that would essentially shut down the Duluth International Airport, not provide any first responder capability, and which is near and dear to the Guard, it would not allow us to do our mission, which is to provide air defense alert, because that is why the federal government funds that. The federal government provides 100% funding for those state employees, and that is to ensure that we do have that crash fire rescue capability.
Are there questions or comments for General Casalter or for Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, I do know that there are members have asked me that
I'm
might want to
I'm going to ask for it. Is there seeing no questions for this witness, thank you, General. Are there others in the audience that wish to testify either in support or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman?
I think the bill has merits, but it needs a little more work to it.
A lot more discussion, I think, is in particular. If you'd identify yourself, please, we'll take brief testimony, and then we are going to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. And it was 2001 when the state employees were on strike. And I would like to just begin by saying that we take the right to strike for our members very seriously. This is an important issue. Here we are 2 days before the deadline. This bill was introduced last week. And we believe that these members have the right to strike. And I just qualify by saying in 2001, to my knowledge, there were no problems when our members at the Duluth Air Base were on strike. With that, I'd stand for questions.
Did you want to comment now?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee representing AFSCME, and I think in addition to what Ms. Blyle said, the last strike prior to that was in 1981, and a strike really is a last resort. Leading up to a strike, any agency that in some sense provides some critical services is able to plan for and cover contingencies. And I think, again, just to reiterate, we support the right to strike and would have a lot of issues with this bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Blyer and Ms. McAfee? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming today, General Casalter, and your witnesses, Senator Prettner-Solon, and Senate File 1974 is laid over.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas has Senate File 1162. Is that correct? Senator Pappas, is that the bill? 1162.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Senator Pappas, you have a...
I have a delete all
delete
the
everything
A3.
Amendment. Senator Pappas offers the A3 amendment.
Madam Chair, while that's being passed out, I can give some introductory comments. Last year, Mr. Bailey from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who's with me today, came and asked me if I would be interested in working on some legislation really in the context of the state bonding bill, because I'm the higher ed chair, and we build a lot of buildings for our state colleges and universities. And why not kind of lead the way in how we build our buildings to demonstrate that it is possible to be climate neutral. In other words, that nothing we build will increase the amount of greenhouse gas reductions of the state. Subsequent to that, there's been a lot more discussions of climate warming, and that's moving in another committee. And we are here today, and we have both limited our bill to the state government, but we've expanded it to include all operations of the state government. The bill before you, Senate File 1162, basically requires a planning process and a report to the legislature examining how state government operations can play an aggressive role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and ultimately become carbon neutral by 2025. The planning process works well with international research, which indicates that significant reductions in greenhouse gases must take place quickly to make the greatest impact on global warming. And it may even be easier for us in state government to be able to do this than it is to organize the private sector. Of course, you know, ultimately it would be better if we had kind of federal leadership on this issue, but we know that absent that, the state and local communities have been kind of filling the void and having a lot more discussion about climate change. This bill will help state government to get the information it needs to become an integral part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Governor Plenty has expressed support to aggressively reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota over the coming years, and this bill will lay the groundwork for the state government itself to become, as I said, the model of greenhouse gas reductions for the rest of the state. Madam Chair, those are my comments, so I would move the A3 amendment.
Senator Pappas moves the A3 amendment. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Are there questions of Senator Pappas? If not, we'll hear briefly from your testifiers.
Then I'd like Mr. John Bailey to comment.
Mr. Bailey.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is John Bailey. I'm with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a nonprofit based in Minneapolis and Washington, D.C. As Senator Pappas mentioned, the governor announced last year that he wanted a stakeholder group to be formed to aggressively reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. I was happy to hear the governor express those desires and that global warming was finally getting some attention here in St. Paul. However, I've observed that in the major global warming bills that are introduced this session, there was not much leadership by the state government itself to be a model of greenhouse gas reductions. And Senator Pappas's bill fills that gap by establishing a planning process to ultimately get the state government to be carbon neutral by 2025. I believe that the state government operations should be going much further and much faster than the state as a whole in terms of greenhouse gas reductions. And governments often lead by example, and they impose stricter standards on themselves than they do on the private sector. In Minnesota, we have Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines that requires state-funded buildings to be 30% more energy efficient than the energy code that is applied to private sector buildings. In Wisconsin, they recently passed a 10% renewable electricity standard, and the state government stepped up and said that they were going to impose a 20% renewable standard, renewable electricity standard for the six largest agencies in Wisconsin. You're seeing carbon neutral initiatives around the country. At the local level, Austin, Texas is now planning to become carbon neutral in terms of their government operations by 2020. Eugene, Oregon is planning for the similar initiative. London, England, and there are other initiatives underway. the architecture community, you know, 40 to 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions are related to operations of buildings. And the architecture community is out front on the global warming issue, and they have an initiative called the 2030 Initiative, and it's been adopted by the American Institute of Architects and the United States Conference of Mayors, and it is an initiative that will gradually make buildings, new buildings, and major renovations more green, more energy efficient, until by 2030 the goal is to have every new building be carbon neutral. In this bill, the carbon neutral planning also includes the Minnesota State University system and the University of Minnesota, and the higher education is also out front on this issue. There's a new initiative. I don't think many people know about it, but it's the American College and University President's Climate Commitment. 146, I believe, as of today, universities and colleges around the country are now committed to plan to reach carbon neutral campuses by as soon as possible, is how the initiative is written. And happily, five of those campuses are in Minnesota. The U of M campus at Morris is signed on, and also the Minsky campus at Winona State is a signatory. I know from discussions with the universities, staff at the universities that are involved in energy issues, that there's a keen interest to develop renewables to supply electricity to the campuses, and they've expressed that there are problems for them getting financing to do these projects, even though they can demonstrate that in the long term they will provide the universities with cost savings. And so that's kind of one of the issues that I think that will come out of this carbon neutral study. You'll see some of these issues like this coming out of the study, and there'll be solutions to those presented. The final point is that the public sector, as Senator Pappas mentioned, is well suited to meet a carbon neutral requirement. You have the ability to finance long-term investments that pay back over a longer period than the private sector is generally apt to invest in. And those investments that will reduce energy consumption will save the state money and also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I hope that you can keep this bill on its path, and we are committed to working with the Department of Commerce and refining the bill to meet the their needs and to integrate it more efficiently into the bigger climate legislation that's ongoing in the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Are there comments or questions for Mr. Bailey?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bailey, I'm a little confused because the study asks for a report to completely reduce or offset greenhouse gas emissions from state government operations. So completely reduce doesn't mean eliminate? Or what are you referring to when you say completely reduce?
Greenhouse gas emissions, for
Mr.
example,
Bailey.
In this building. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Greenhouse gas emissions in this building, for example, can be calculated based on the energy consumption. So for the electricity side, you will base it on the electricity or the fuels being used to generate electricity for the power that supplies this building, Xcel Energy, for example. And that's true on a university campus. Well, if the university campus is now generating its own electricity from wind, biomass, that those emissions are now zero or can be calculated to be zero. So the exercise will be to calculate your greenhouse gas emissions based on your energy consumption.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So in the mandate part here, where we're looking at the reductions by certain time periods, but this is what's confusing. It says achieve carbon neutral operations, but then it says like by 2025, 100% reduction. Does that mean that everyone would have to have biomass or wind energy in order to achieve that?
Well, Madam Chair. Senator, the two primary ways you can reduce greenhouse gases are to use less energy to begin with, or to use energy that is renewable. So what we're talking about here is a renewable-fueled state government for the energy that they do use. And this bill, well, I don't know what the plan is going to say, that what can be done, but I would envision a plan that would encourage a great deal of energy conservation in state government, because energy conservation, of course, you're not paying for the energy, so you save money in the end by investing in it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
With that in mind, we're kind of putting the horse before, or the cart before the horse here, I think, because we're asking for a study that's going to be done by 2008. And then by 2010, we're already supposed to have 50%, and then 70% by 2015, and 100% by 2025. Yet we don't know what the study says of how manageable this is for our state government to do. And so I would think and would propose, Madam Chair, an amendment to put a period after operations on line 113 and delete all of the lines following, so that we can get the study, come back in 2008, and then we can set our standards after we know how reasonable or probable it is to accomplish this. I mean, I have no idea how much money it would take, how possible it is to do without having the study first.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bailey or Senator Pappas? She's offering an amendment, so I think I need to ask Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas, Senator Roebling is moving to amend this bill to insert a period after operations on line 13 and delete all the following new language. Would you like to comment?
Just parameters for this study.
It's not. Okay.
We're giving the...
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that quickly, I'm not saying we can't come back and set these kinds of standards,
right,
but I just think that it's premature to do it right now before the study is completed.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I just consulted with Mr. Bailey that we're actually not setting standards in the bill. We're setting a parameter for the study. So they would come back from the study and let us know what it would take to get to this point, and then we decide about whether it's doable, or then we decide how we implement it. So it's aggressive, you know, and I've talked to Mr. Garvey with the Department of Commerce, and it's an aggressive idea, and they may say that it's not doable, like you said, to be able to reduce it 50% by the end of 2010. So that's what the report will say. But it might be doable to do it by 2012. No. But we want them to take a very aggressive look at and really let us know what we would have to do in order to implement it under this guideline. But they're not standards.
Senator Roebling?
So these are not standards. They're only standards for the study.
Right.
But the standards are not being adopted here.
Right.
No.
That's correct.
Okay. It isn't, I mean, it wasn't very clear to me when it looked like these were standards to achieve carbon neutral operations. And
I think the operative language is in line 111, where it says the recommendations must be guided by a goal, which is not the same thing as saying setting standards to do this themselves.
That's right, Madam Chair. It is a study. It's not implementation language. The study would tell us what we would have to do, what we'd have to implement in order to reach the goal. But we haven't adopted the goal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
Even at that, it might be outdated faster than we could ever implement it, because the study's coming back in 2008. And half of the emissions are supposed to be, according to the study, we should have a plan to eliminate half of the emissions by 2010. So that is highly aggressive. I mean, I don't know that we take about a two-year cycle around here to do things. So I don't know that it's very practical to put in such a early date for that first that first deadline, even in a study.
Senator Roebling has made an amendment to the delete all amendment. Is there any other discussion of it?
Madam Chair, I would be willing to leave in some of the timelines with a suggestion that we push back that first one a couple of years.
Madam Chair, why don't we push that back to 2012?
Oh, jeez.
Let's see. See how
Senator
that works.
Roebling?
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling withdraws her amendment.
Right.
And instead, Senator Roebling moves on line 115 to delete 2010 and insert 2012. Is that understood by the members? Any further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, and this actually isn't the last word on these guidelines because this bill has to go to energy, and we'll want to integrate these guidelines with the bigger climate study that's going on. And so I think there is going to be some inconsistency. They haven't determined what those guidelines are yet, but as this gets integrated into the bigger study, it'll get adjusted.
Did your other witness wish to speak?
I wanted to introduce Ms. Heidi Myers, who's the state architect, and she's been working for a number of years with the sustainable building guidelines, and I'd like to ask her to comment.
If you would, please, Ms. Myers.
Madam Chair, my name is Heidi Myers. I'm the state architect with the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration concurs with the initiative of this bill to reduce greenhouse gases, and we support the concept of first studying a plan before we actually do with the implementation of it.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Chair, if I could, I always go ahead. I heard you say that you concur with the initiative of the bill or something. Does that mean, can you be succinct, does the Department of Administration support this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator
Gerlach.
Yes, we
Myers.
Do.
We do. Okay. I wanted to be clear. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1162 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Chaudhry here. He's been here and gone. Senator Betzold.
Right.
Senator Betzold brings us Senate File 1873, Executive Order Expiration and State Commissioner Confirmation Clarification.
You're wearing me out, I'll tell you that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1873 raises an issue that you might recall Senator Jen Olson asked us on the floor earlier this session why we were going through confirmation hearings for the governor's appointees. After they were basically the same appointees from his first term. And there's a little bit of a history here to understand why we're there. Up until 1962, the governor always had two-year terms, as did the House. The Senate had four-year terms. But the commissioners were not always coterminous terms with the governor. Sometimes they had two-year terms, sometimes four-year terms, sometimes six-year terms. And, in fact, it wasn't always the governor that made the appointments. First, the Commissioner of Education was appointed by the Board of Education. That ultimately was straightened out to have the commissioner's terms line up with the governor's terms. Then there was another situation in the mid-1970s when Governor Wendell Anderson resigned and Lieutenant Governor Perpich became governor. But Governor Perpich was then basically stuck with the commissioners that Governor Anderson had because there wasn't anything that said that the new governors could appoint new commissioners. So that was also changed. One of the things that has been in law with all these things that have happened over the years, with changing the governor's terms and so forth, is the fact that when a governor made his appointments, the appointments were for a definitive term. That is the term of office of the governor. If the governor vacated, that is voluntarily left during that term, then the new governor could make new appointments. But there wasn't anything about what happens if a governor serves a term and then serves another term. In the case of either Governor Quay or Governor Ventura, they were elected to a term. They didn't leave. They served their term, and then a new governor took place. But in the case of both Governor Arne Carlson and prior to that Governor Rudy Perpich, they did serve a term, then were reelected to another term, and in both cases, the law required they submitted their old commissioners to the Senate for new confirmations because the commissioners in their first term had only been appointed for a definitive period of time, and that is the period of time that the governor served in the first term. So there really is no provision in law under which if a governor is reelected, that the commissioners from the first term carry over into the second term. This bill would do that. In addition, it just clarifies in Section 1, it does talk about the fact that any executive orders by the governor, if a governor vacates the office, that is, leaves in the middle of the term, those executive orders would expire 90 days after the governor leaves midterm. But it doesn't say what happens if the governor just plain leaves, that is, serves a term, or anyway, in order to make everything line up, we have to change the terminology here. But the real guts of this bill is in Section 2, basically, which would allow the commissioners of the first term to carry over into the second term without the necessity of having to resubmit all those commissioners again for confirmation. That's what the bill does. I suspect the governor would be quite appreciative of this bill, and here it is, Madam Chair. I don't know of any opposition to it. This is, frankly, a matter for the Minnesota Senate, since the Minnesota Senate is the one that makes the confirmations, and I believe this is something that, you know, probably makes some good sense. It lines up with what happens on the federal level with the president as well, too, because if the president is elected to a second term, I don't think that they have to resubmit the presidential appointees again. I think Mr. Watson can also provide any additional background that the committee may desire, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel, I noticed in the first section that you changed the word vacates to leaves, but you did not do that in the second section. Was there a reason for that?
I think Mr. Watson can address that.
Madam Chair, absolutely. That the difference is that in the case of the executive orders, they do carry over from one term to the next. There's no particular reason why they shouldn't. But the commissioner appointments are quite different, that in order to get them subject to Senate confirmation a second time, it can't be said that they continue until the governor leaves office.
Okay, I just want to make sure that, because that's what the difference is between Section 1 and 2. I just want to make sure people understand that.
Yes.
Are there questions for Senator Betzel? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to comment either in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1873 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Roebling. We want to go to your bills. Senator Roebling has Senate File 1436. Is that the one you'd like to start
Madam
with?
Chair, the state auditor is on her way over and not here yet, so if
okay,
it
how about
okay,
1419?
I would like to take that one first.
Okay, we have Senate File 1419 before us.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1419 is designed to give Scott County some greater flexibility in becoming the best employer and public employer in the state. But they have a little competition because they would like to incorporate into the way that they hire a number of provisions that are currently in being used by the state of Minnesota. And they started to look for a better system of hiring, and lo and behold, they found out that Minnesota was being held up as a model, and they had an article in Governing Magazine even pointing to what we had done in 2004 to improve our hiring process. And so they are asking us to allow them to modify their personnel administration system. And I have with me today Lori Huss from Employment Relations in Scott County and Dave Unmock, our Scott County Administrator, to explain the request in more detail to you.
And Senator Roebling, before she does this is not codified law, correct? This is not something going in the statutes. This is just going into session law. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
McGowan.
Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It will be in the session laws only.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
We were hoping that this would be permanent permission for them to operate under this model.
Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, it's still law. It's just not codified law.
It's just not codified law. It doesn't go in the statute books.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's fine. Because there are some sections that we were wondering why we didn't just refer to them instead of reprinting the whole section, because it would have lengthened the publication costs quite a bit if we did it the way it is currently being done. So if it's not going in statute books, that's probably a good thing.
That's why, yes. Sir, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Reston, members of the committee. My name is David Unmacht. I'm the Scott County Administrator. I've served in this capacity for the past 10 years. My introductory comments will be very brief this afternoon. My tenure in local government administration extends past the 25-year mark, and in this past quarter century, I've witnessed, in some cases, led some significant changes in the way local government operates as it carries out the policies of the state, the decisions of our local elected officials, and the work of the public. One of the most striking changes in the overall work we do in local government has been the level of professionalism in our industry that is now required. From land use planning to the criminal justice system, from transportation and transit services, to overseeing elections and audits, the complexity of local government in today's world has changed and evolved dramatically over the course of the past two decades, and now more than ever demands a higher level of professionalism, more and more accountability and management, and both efficiency and creativity in our operations. This bill reflects the needs of this evolving level of professional accountability, and it also reflects the most basic principles of good government. In short, this legislative change will allow us the flexibility to hire the right people for the right job at the right time. In short, this legislation allows Scott County to uphold the principles of its mission, which is to deliver quality public services to all citizens in an effective, professional, and efficient manner. In addition to that, Senator Roebling mentioned about being the best public service provider. Our county board's vision is to be the best in the business as both an employer and a provider of services. So this fits very well with the county's vision. We now have the technology to make this change to our personnel systems happen. We have the professional capacity to make it happen, but perhaps more importantly, the changing demands and needs of our citizens compel us to make it happen. At this point, I'd like to hand over the remaining time to my colleague, Lori Huss, who can explain the legislative request in more detail. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lori Huss, and I am the Employee Relations Representative at Scott County. And as both the Senator and Dave Unmacht have mentioned, we are seeking really a best practices change. That's what this is about. We found back when we set our vision to be the best public services provider and employer in the business, we did some research and found that the state does have very good hiring practices, and so we simply want to follow their lead with that. The goals of our legislation are really very simple. It's to engage in a more prudent use of the key resources of technology, money, time, and talent. And we're doing that by asking to be allowed to operate under an applicant pool system rather than an eligible list system. What that does and what that means for an applicant and for our hiring managers is that a person can apply one time to the organization of Scott County and be considered based on their talents and skills across the organization and put into the position that's best fitting for that. And that's what the state moved to, and it works very well. In addition, the second change that would be required would be to allow us to operate our veterans' preference in the same manner that the state does it, which is different than the county system. That's the only change. It's how the state does it instead of how the counties do it. So those are the two changes that we're asking for. And again, it's really about best practices. We want to do a really good job. We want to make sure that we are recruiting for positions in ways that candidates expect because of technology changes and time constraints. So that is what it's about. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Roebling or her witnesses on this request from Scott County?
Madam Chair?
Is there? Mm-hmm.
We plan to do this so well that soon all the other counties will want us to just give them a blanket approval to do this in the future. But we're willing to serve as a model for the system that the state has effectively used and bringing it into a county system.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Senator, seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate file number 1419 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Roebling.
Where's it go, Madam Chair? Where's it go?
Floor. The next bill is also Senator Roebling's. We're going to take this one. Senate file 1436, and then we'll, after we deal with this, we'll move right away to Senator Chaudhry's bill. Senator Roebling, 1436.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 1436 is one that has been in front of this committee before. It made it part of the way through the process last year and died somewhere in the process, mainly because of a lack of time at the end and other circumstances. But it has been approved by the committee before, and the whole first section pretty well redefines the political subdivision, and so it's pretty technical in nature. But then the second section asks that we do a requirement of audits for some of our special taxing district in the same shape that we do for our regular municipalities and townships, and that they use the same standards. So if a township of 100 that has revenues of $150,000 or less would follow the same standard as a city or a township that would do that, if the special taxing district would do the same thing. And a lot of this applies to like watershed districts in particular, but it's all districts that generate money from the public either through property taxes or special assessment fees. And we do feel that we have an interest in having proper oversight over these special taxing districts, and I think that this will help give us that, this particular provision. And I have with me our state auditor, Rebecca Otto, and she has supported it, as did our previous state auditor, and I'd like to have her make a few comments about it.
Welcome to the committee, Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a good bill. It's pretty non-controversial. It's almost technical in nature. We are required to do a special district report, and I think it was discovered that there are a lot of special districts, and we don't necessarily know where they all are. So one of the provisions just basically makes newly created ones report to us so we know who they are. So it's a good government bill, and hope that you will be able to pass it today.
So thank you, Ms. Otto. So Senator Roebling, we don't have a summary of it, so I just want to understand what the changes are that are being made. What you do first is to have these new definitions for political subdivision and special districts in Section 1. Mm-hmm. And then following that, in general, whenever you're talking about a local unit of government, you either are, or some other entity, you are changing that to refer to political subdivisions. And so that's what happens through 2, 3, 4, yes, and so on, until you get to the sections that the state auditor was just referring to, which is this new definition of special district over which then she would have some jurisdiction, and that new language is the really new language is in Section 19.
That's correct, Madam
Chair.
So
if members wanted to look for new language rather than just the cross-references about what the state auditor's responsibility would be toward these special districts, the place to look is the definition and then the operative Section 19. Is that about it?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And Mark Kerr, an attorney from the State Auditor's Office, is here and could give a little bit more information about the new section in particular.
Okay. Mr. Kerr?
Thank you. My name is Mark Kerr. I'm Assistant Legal Counsel at the Office of the State Auditor. We discovered in our through doing our special district finance report that a lot of money goes through the special districts, and so the idea here is to, as Auditor Otto said, know who they are by having them report when they're created, their articles of incorporations or bylaws or other documents that create them, but also to create a general audit requirement that is exactly the same as the one that applies to towns and cities with combined clerk treasurers. And you can see the cross-reference there to the revenue level in Section 14.591. That's the city provision that has the $150,000 annual revenue level that Senator Roebling referred to. It does increase each year by inflation. So for 2006, it would be $166,901, and that will increase each year using the implicit price deflator.
And that and that is defined in the 412-591.
Yes, in
that.
The cross mm-hmm. reference. Thank you. So if they have revenue over that amount, they need to have an annual audit. If they have revenue equal to that amount or less, they need to have an audit once every 5 years, and that's exactly the same as applies to towns with a combined clerk treasurer and small cities with a combined clerk treasurer. One other item in this section is a requirement that they complete, present, and file their annual audit within 180 days after the end of the district's fiscal year. We found when we did our report that some entities were not, even if they had an audit requirement, they just weren't having it done, or they were waiting a long period of time to get it done, so it wasn't a very good tool to use in their planning or to keep track of what they were doing because it was so old. So the 180 days is meant to prevent tardiness in getting that prepared.
Okay, are there questions about the definitions or the new responsibility for, or clarified responsibility for the auditor? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, everybody knows I'm very strong with local government. I'm trying to figure out, am I reading this right? Do you take anything away from local government?
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, Senator Vickerman, no, we're not taking anything away. We're asking them to provide regular audit information from the special taxing districts only. The local governments already have that requirement, but this would apply it to the special taxing district, which is oftentimes districts like watershed districts, and put them under the same umbrella as the townships and the small cities.
Is there further discussion or comments for Senator Roebling? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Welcome to the committee, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ray Bone. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and we believe this is a good bill. We think this one thing it does is it certainly puts us on par with the other local units of government in terms of our financial responsibilities. We believe it gives the auditor more flexibility and also brings more consistency in dealing with the with special taxing districts like ourselves. I think it also clarifies our responsibilities as it relates to the financial audits. And I think many of the provisions we actually do in one form or another presently, like, for example, the lobbyist provision, we've been voluntarily submitting that, I think, since day one. So we believe this is, in short, a good bill, and we hope you would support it. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Roebling, is there anyone else who wishes to comment? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Roebling. Senator Chaudhry? Senator Chaudhry brings Senate File 1137. And we have the first engrossment of this bill coming to us from the Committee on Environment. Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1137 contains revisions to Minnesota's Wetland Conservation Act. The Environment Committee spent five hearings discussing wetlands in general and with respect to two pieces of legislation. The underlying issue behind this legislation is that in 1991, when the Wetland Conservation Act was created, there were provisions that even though wetlands would be drained, there would be no net loss of wetlands in our state, meaning if wetland was drained, a wetland would be replaced somewhere else. However, presentations were heard by reports from conferences on wetlands, as well as from the Board of Water and Soil Resources state agency, that the promise of no net loss to our wetlands has not been kept. And that is due to a variety of issues within the Wetland Conservation Act that are allowed to happen. It was the numbers presented by Bowser that Minnesota is indeed undergoing a net loss of wetlands, and it was testimony by various groups that allows for an entire lake to be drained, that it allows for, and there was an example given on that in the city of Hugo, that there are concrete stormwater ponds that are allowed to be counted as wetland replacements, the discussion went on and on. So the Environment Committee spent an inordinate amount of time discussing the issue. There were two bills that were presented, two by myself, one furthered by the Minnesota Citizens for Environmental Advocacy, and then the other by Bowser itself.
Senator Chaudhry, we really don't have jurisdiction over the policy that you adopted, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. But we do have jurisdiction over the authority to issue rules or to be exempted from them, and I wonder if you would now direct your testimony to lines 14, 9, 10, and 11, in which you are requiring the board to develop rules and why you're going the rulemaking way rather than putting the application, implementation, et cetera, actually into statute and instead accomplishing that by rule, wanting sure. to do that by rule.
Madam Chair, so the bill we have before us is a blend of proposals. The rulemaking part of the proposal is parts of the bill are primarily coming out of the Bowser proposal to amend their rules so that they can act better on wetland provisions. So
The board that's referred to in line 14.9 is which board?
Madam Chair, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Bowser.
So that board is the Bowser board there. Okay, are there questions with regard to rulemaking? Is there any other section in the bill that is the jurisdiction here, Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair and members, Section 1 is also Section under the one. Jurisdiction of the committee, and there is language in statute that you don't see printed in the bill. The general concept here is that all state agencies are subject to a time deadline for acting in response to a request for a permit or license or similar items. And the basic concept is I believe they have 60 days to respond to that request. If they don't respond, it's considered approved. Mm-hmm. So the bill is making some changes that you see on page 2.
So, Madam Chair, this section has been the source of a considerable discussion. We actually do have there's some disagreement, particularly with the Builders Association of Minnesota, but others on this section, and we actually do have through some very intense negotiations, some different language to offer the committee on this, and I believe that Mr. Bodern has that amendment.
Madam Chair, I haven't had time to get it put into the revisor system. It is an oral amendment. It's about two sentences in length. I can describe it to the committee if you wish, and we can proceed.
That would be okay. Senator Betzel, did you have a question
I had a question on a different issue, but...
Senator Betzel, would you be kind enough to move this amendment so we can have it before us to discuss?
Well, let's hear what the amendment is.
Okay. I'll call on you then. Mr. Byron.
Beginning on, Madam Chair, beginning on page 1, line 22, after response, insert, including an approval with conditions, and then on page 1, line 23, after the period, insert a new sentence that reads as follows, failure to satisfy the conditions, if any, may be a basis to revoke or rescind the approval by the agency and will not give rise to a claim that the 60-day time limit was not met. Then, corresponding with that on page 2, delete the new paragraph E that you see on lines 6 through 11 and the new paragraph coding.
So I think we need to have that read again.
Certainly, Madam Chair. And I'll read the way the complete paragraph C would read with the amendment would be, an agency response, including an approval with conditions, meets the 60-day time limit if the agency can document that the response was sent within 60 days of receipt of the written request. Failure to satisfy the conditions, if any, may be a basis to revoke or rescind the approval by the agency and will not give rise to a claim that the 60-day time limit was not met.
Also move.
Senator Betzel moves the oral amendment as read to us by counsel. Want to make sure that people understand the impact of the amendment. Senator Chaudhry?
I'm going to need some of our more technical people to explain the actual impact compared to what we've...
Do you want to talk about it?
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm the legal director with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We are one of the groups that has been working with the board and other interested parties on this. The amendment here is the result of a lot of hard work with the parties on the bill.
Just tell us what the difference is between the language is there
absolutely.
And what the amendment does.
The language that was in the bill limited application of the so-called 60-day rule in Minnesota Statutes 15.99
because there were concerns that certain technical wetland information took longer than 60 days to finish. Okay. And that was putting local governments in a tough spot. And what has been worked out now, the amendment that is before you, is instead of just exempting wetland work from the 60-day rule, which would leave it rather open-ended, this amendment says that local governments can condition approval and can then wait for wetland work to be done. So they will meet the 60-day deadline. Developers or others that are interested aren't waiting for that, but they aren't in danger of sort of getting caught with bad wetland work or not having enough time. That wetland work can be a condition, can be completed later, and will not put them in danger of violating the rule.
I'm pulling it tonight.
Okay. Senator Chaudhary, we're informed that this would apply to other state agencies as well, not just to Bowser.
Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is my understanding that the 60-day rule applies to a number of different government entities, so this would apply across the board, yes.
So this is a fairly significant change.
Madam Chair, members of the board, it's a fairly significant change in the sense of that it is affecting a lot of agencies, but a lot of agencies do have to make the wetland decisions. A lot of agencies do use the conditional approval process. So its intent is to just make sure that they can use those conditional approvals without running afoul of the rule.
Is there anyone, are there any questions for Senator Chaudhary on this issue? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, as we go through this bill, I serve on the same, in fact, I'm a co-author on the bill, trying to make this bill better. Mm-hmm. But I've got a lot of concerns from agriculture industries. And I agreed with Senator Chaudhary, we would send it here, and then hopefully it'll come back to the Ag Committee. And I have no intention of killing the bill, I just want to make the bill a little comfort zone there, and I think in Senator Chaudhary, I hope we agree on that issue. So that's what that would be my only question. I hope you'd send it to.
Okay, well, let's deal with the amendment first. Does everyone understand the amendment? Is there anyone who wishes to speak to the amendment from a state agency? Seeing none and there being no questions, Senator Betzel moves the amendment as read to us by counsel. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, we also have an amendment relating to rulemaking that Mr. Bodden has drafted.
Okay. This is an additional amendment to the one that we identified on lines, or additional section that we identified on page 14.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
And this is going to be inserted page 18.
Correct. Madam Chair, this is a section that was deleted upon my motion in the Environment Committee because of objections from some local entities. Since then, we have reworked the language of that bill so that it is acceptable to Association of Minnesota Counties, Townships, League of Cities. I think and Mr. Forget the whole name of Mr. Carlson's group, but Mr. Carlson was the one who objected to the section, and he's the one who we worked out this new language with.
So the effect of this amendment, and then I'll ask someone to offer it, but tell us the effect of this amendment.
The effect of this amendment, Madam Chair, is that Bowser is allowed to engage in emergency rulemaking only on the items within this statute. The objection was that Bowser was allowed to engage in emergency rulemaking in general, with regards to any particular topic on wetlands. And so that was the concern, and we've since narrowed it down so that
it's
only within
a limited
correct
exemption from regular rulemaking to do emergency rulemaking.
Correct.
And Senator Betzel.
And Senator Chaudhary, could you just clarify again why we would want to exempt them from rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14? What's the reason for doing that?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel.
Senator Chaudhary.
We are exempting them from the normal rulemaking guidelines, which would take about 2 years to implement the rules of this statute. We would like to give Bowser the authority to implement the rules of this, implement the contents of the statute quicker than that.
And Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhary, I don't know if that's a good deal or a bad deal. Sometimes it's a good idea to extend it out. I mean, if Bowser says, yes, we'd like to go faster, that doesn't necessarily mean it's in the public interest to do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, we have Bowser here to talk a little bit about that. The Environment Committee did review this pretty closely. The primary objection was not that we implement the contents of this bill quickly, but we implement a broad range of rules in an emergency fashion, and we took that portion out. But why don't we hear from Mr. Jaski?
Mr. Jaspers.
Madam Chair, John Jaski, Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Senator Betzel's question, this is being put in here primarily as a local government administration function. This law is administered by counties, cities, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts across the state, and what we've done this three times before successfully, so I'll give you that assurance. I believe we can do it again. What it allows us to do is to take the provisions in a law that are changed, add them to the rule immediately, because the local governments use the rule as a standalone document to administer this program. And then what we do is those rules are in place for no more than 2 years, and we replace them with permanent rules during that time frame.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel, Mr. Bonnard has a comment on how Bowser approaches rulemaking now. Apparently they do have some authority to do accelerated rulemaking. Mr. Bonnard.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, in Chapter 14, which applies to all state agencies, there is a section that basically allows for accelerated rulemaking if the rule is intended to incorporate specific changes that are in statute when no interpretation of law is required. That process requires, it allows an agency simply to provide notice of the rule, take a couple of, it's an accelerated time frame. The rule needs to be approved as to legality by the Office of Administrative Hearings and so forth. But you don't have the typical rulemaking process providing for comment and kind of an extended hearing if it's requested. What this amendment does, among other things, it requires that these steps be taken within 90 days of the effective date of the section. There's nothing in the statute applying to rulemaking that requires that, so this would require Bowser to do that immediately. It also eliminates the notice requirement that is contained in the current statutory authority they would have to use to incorporate statutory changes. So it's basically more accelerated than that. All they would have to do is get the reviser to approve the form of the rule. They'd have to sign that it was, in fact, an order that they were adopting the rule on behalf of the agency, and the Office of Administrative Hearings would have to approve the rule within 14 days and then simply publish it in the state register, and it would take effect.
So, Madam Senator Chair, Mr. Bodern, even with accelerated rulemaking, is notice required?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, under the typical the process required by Section 14.388, yes, there is notice is required. But under 14.386, which is referenced here, you'll see that on page 1, line 10 of the amendment, it's basically the four steps I outlined to you. The reviser approves the rule. The agency, which is authorized to adopt the rule, signs an order adopting it. Office of Administrative Hearings has 14 days to approve the rule, and then they publish a copy in the state register, which could be presumed to be noticed, but there's no time frame for waiting after that. It's effective on publication.
And these are rules that specifically relate to, you were saying, just putting the statute statutory provisions in place that don't require any interpretation of the statute.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And it's attested to by, through that process, starting with the revisor under 14386. Is that right? Do I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, in the existing statutory provision that would apply without this amendment, the revisor needs to review it. And let's see. Yes, and under 14.386 as well. That process is in place in both sections.
Are there further questions about the amendment? And we'll take testimony in just a moment, but let's understand what it does first. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I understand what it does, and I'm just trying to figure out the purpose here, because we have some things that certain landowners, I suspect, might want to do before this would take effect, and the quicker this can take effect, the less time they have to do it. Something we don't want, like drain wetlands. Is that part of the thought behind this? Because I'm looking at this new section on page 3.32. If they were to drain wetlands and then not keep it in agricultural use for at least 10 years, they could have a deed restriction put on it. And so are you perceiving that as a problem, that people might be moving ahead to do these projects before the rule or the law can take effect?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, no, I think is a short answer. The main and really the only function of this provision is to allow the statute and the rule to become the same thing very quickly so that our local governments, the 300 or so that administer this program, can work from a document and a set of standards that are clear and the citizens who they're interacting with can clearly understand them. So if you can imagine the statute and the rule being different, saying different things, and then someone having to interpret how they fit together, that's very challenging for the many local governments who administer this. We want to make it one document that they understand and apply. That's the sole purpose.
So the effective date is not different.
No. Yeah, Madam Chair, instead of looking at the effective date is not affected by this provision of the statutory changes.
Senator Roebling, we need Mr. Carlson. Do you want to? And if anyone else wishes to testify on this amendment, please come to the table, either in support or in opposition. Mr. Carlson, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I was correctly identified by Senator Chaudhry as the testifier who had raised concerns about the previous provision that gave the agency broad rulemaking, exempt rulemaking authority in the earlier version of this bill before the Environment Committee. This morning, a number of representatives of counties, including county commissioners and county staff, met with Mr. Jaski and his staff, and I believe we came to an understanding. One of those was that we would agree to limited exempt rulemaking authority under the conditions that, one, despite the fact that the exempt rulemaking authority has identified by your council has no formal process for input, that they would take into consideration and involve us in the process in adopting those rules. And I would like to go on just a little bit further, that basically the intent of those rules, specifically with regards to wetland replacement and banking provisions, which really are not specifically addressed in the bill, would not go beyond those provided for by the Corps of Engineers, which in many circumstances is really the rules under which we operate. So they would not, in the aspect of replacement ratios, go beyond what was required by the Corps, or in the aspect of what qualifies for wetland banking, be less restrictive than what the Corps provided for. With that understanding, we are okay with this amendment.
I would point out to members, too, that as council has indicated, that there's at least a 30-day period where the notice has to be given to chairs of the appropriate legislative committees with jurisdiction over these issues. So there is some notice requirement that is provided. Senator Marty, would you move the amendment?
I would move it.
Senator Marty moves the A11 amendment. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak either in support or opposition to this amendment? Are there other questions on the amendment for Senator Chaudhry? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A11 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Chaudhry, there is an appropriation in the bill, which means that at some point we'll go to finance. But Senator Vickerman, are you requesting this bill, instead of going to finance, come to your committee? Or it will go to finance and go to your division. I forgot. You have the division in finance that would be appropriate for this bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, quick question. Did it go to finance?
It goes to finance and then
before it came to your committee?
No.
Okay.
No. It went to environment and then here. And then it will go to finance and the finance chair will decide which division it is appropriate.
Okay. Right. And Madam Chair, Senator Vickerman, you can certainly have this discussion in the Agriculture Committee as well. It will also need to come back to my committee as well, because we've got some additional work that we want to amend and massage, and that has to do with the Environment Policy Committee as well. So there are a couple more stops to go on this.
Senator Chaudhry,
and you sit on that committee.
The Finance Committee is unlikely to send a bill coming out of the Finance Committee back to the Policy Committee, just to, as I'm finding out on another issue.
Well, Madam Chair, then.
I mean, you may want to have amendments in the Finance Committee that reflects the thoughts of the Environment Committee, but I'm just letting you know that.
Okay.
Is not likely.
Well, let me ask you
our
this.
Our next step would ordinarily be to the Finance Committee.
Let me ask you this: the appropriations are in Senator Anderson's Environment Finance Omnibus Bill. Do we need to carry them in this bill then?
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair.
Can save the finance step and just keep working on the policy?
Well, Madam Chair, sometimes there are outlier bills that are going on their own that have fiscal implications, but at some point the Finance Committee usually wants to see the bill so that they can look at the fiscal note as it lines up with the bill. Now, if there are still policy committees that have to be done, I would think that you'd want to keep the policy side of the House first. And you can send us the Ag and Vets Policy Committee, and they can process it and move it out to the floor, and then it can be moved back to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. But ultimately, it's going to have to go. But once you send the Finance Committee, that's usually the last stop of a bill before the floor. You don't want to send a Finance and then send it to a Policy Committee.
I see. And I was confused, too. Ag and Veterans operates like transportation does. It's both policy sites. And finance. So in order to have it go to another policy committee, we would appropriately send it to the Ag and Veterans Committee.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
This committee, of course, does not have the expertise in some of the areas, but I hope that Senator Vickerman's committee or Senator Chaudhry's committee does take another look at Section 9, because they does have a local government impact, I'm told, on some of these wetlands mitigation. And although this is a state and local government operations committee, we normally don't get into these fine details on how the wetlands work, but I believe that there's an impact there that I think should be addressed and looked at a little bit more thoroughly. But this committee obviously doesn't have the jurisdiction or the expertise to delve into those details, but I think that is an issue that they need to look at.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair,
Thank
Senator
you for
Betzel, there are a number of sections that are undergoing more work and will probably see more revision. But for today's purposes, we limited it to the sections relevant to this committee. But, for example, the stormwater provision, we will be massaging that as well. And I've met with counties, particularly our county, Anoka County, in some of these matters.
Okay, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 1137, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Agriculture and Veterans Affairs.
Madam Chair, just a quick question, because we do have local government jurisdiction here, and I'm wondering, like, we're making some bigger changes, like on page 13, on line 13.6, from 400 to 100 square feet. We're cutting a lot of these in half, but that one is even greater than that. But I don't have the information here to tell me anything about what a 1, 2, 6, or 7 wetland is, for example. And I'm wondering, how does this affect road construction in particular? That's one of my big questions, because that certainly does affect what our cities and counties and townships have to deal with.
Senator Chartering?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The de minimis exemption, by way of background, refers to what you're required or what you're not required to replace if you drain a wetland. So de minimis doesn't say you can't drain this wetland. It says this is the threshold at which you have to replace a wetland. So currently, if you drain 5,000 square feet of a type 2, 1, 2, 6, or 7 wetland, and we can provide those definitions to you, then you don't have to replace that amount anywhere. You're exempt because that is considered de minimis. This bill says that, well, 5,000 square feet is not really de minimis. That's a large amount. And so we're reducing that amount by which you are required to replace the wetlands. And so if a road construction did, I'm going to have to defer to someone else on the road construction question, but on the, with regards to de minimis, but when we've got the other section where we talk about stormwater, not counting as a wetland replacement credit, that would also, that does affect road construction as any other commercial development. So one of the things that we're working on is to say that if, and this is discussion that we've had with counties and as well as the builders group, is that if they are replacing a wetland with stormwater, but that stormwater pond is in the type or functions like a wetland for all practical purposes, then that would in fact count. So I'm saying in the bill that stormwater ponds don't count as wetlands for wetland replacement credit purposes. But if you do create something like a wetland, then that would count. We'll make sure, and I've discussed this with my own county to make sure that counts for road construction as well. I haven't formulated that language yet. That's something I anticipate introducing either in Senator Vickerman's committee, more than likely back in my committee.
Okay, so, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
So if you might be defining what that stormwater pond would look like. So if it's a deep pond that couldn't grow cattails, couldn't serve as wildlife habitat, couldn't do a lot of things, then it wouldn't count probably. But right. You're trying to figure out a way that some of them could be developed so that they would serve a typical wetland purpose.
Correct.
And you're yes. Going to follow through and do
yes.
That because
yes.
I think that can happen. I think it's
absolutely.
Possible.
Absolutely.
And so then we should be able to give them credit for that.
Absolutely.
But, Madam Chair, just quickly, what are the differences between, I've seen the schedule a long time ago, but it's not fresh in my mind, like a type 1, 2, or 6 wetland going from, for example, 2,000 feet to 1,000 square feet.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I won't go into all the detail, but
you need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm John Jasky, Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, The wetland types that are listed there, the 1, 2, 6, and 7, are wetlands that have saturated soil with plants growing on them. And the wetland the types that are not listed there, the 3, 4s, and 5s, are the ones that have open water. That's the general distinction that I would make. And the reason there's different types listed is that, you know, over the course of the years this law has been in place, there's been a favoritism, I guess, given to those type 3, 4s, and 5s, the open water ones, as being worthy of greater protection. So that's the bottom line, why there are certain ones of them are given more protection and others are given less. Public value is the general term people use for that. They have more public value.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
This does raise
getting
a few questions.
Getting far afield from our jurisdiction, Senator Roebling.
Because, they're not obvious wetlands. You have to examine them closely to see what kind of plants are growing on them, for example. And I haven't heard any testimony from the cities and counties and townships if they're satisfied.
Senator Roebling, this would not be the committee for them to comment on that. Here we're talking about the rulemaking authority only, and if they are satisfied with the rulemaking authority and the notices, it would be in the Ag Committee or in the Environment Committee for them to talk about the actual changes and definitions of wetlands.
But, Madam Chair,
it greatly affects their operations. That's not where we cross this issue, it seems to me. I guess, it's a gray area, but...
And so I don't know. I mean, I just would kind of like to know where they're at with this, if they're comfortable or not. I mean, we'll see this again later in several capacities, but I don't know if they think this is going to pose an extreme hardship on them, a small hardship, hardly any hardship at all, as they develop roads, for example.
Well, you're certainly welcome to testify in support of the major provisions of the bill or in opposition to it. But I don't want to get into the environment policy here. Would you like to comment? Okay. If you would identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Fisher. I'm the Anoka County Highway Engineer, and I represented the Minnesota County Engineers Association during the stakeholders process for the review of the Wetland Conservation Act. Also worked very closely with AMC Association of Minnesota Counties and MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And I think it is very appropriate that this committee is hearing this bill as it is. As you heard Mr. Jaski say, there's over 300 local government units that have to implement the Wetland Conservation Act. And you also heard that in the past, when we did exempt from the rulemaking authority and go to the emergency rules, that has been a success, and that has been a success when we agreed with the statutory changes that were made, and we did want to align the law with the rule so that we could implement that program. The issue that I'd like to say for the record is that, and it might relate to policy, and I know we want to talk about the rule here, but there are provisions in here, especially the Subdivision 9 that was brought up, the de minimis, that will be very onerous to local governments to implement. There will be very little environmental benefit at a very large expense to local governments to implement that. So, and there are other provisions. And, again, that hopefully can be addressed through the policy committees, but again, and I had plenty of notes to go through. I know you want to keep this limited to that, but that's where emergency rulemaking is problematic, is when us as agencies trying to implement this act and changes in statute we don't agree with, and then we're going to have those problems. Again, we do like aligning these things quickly when we're in agreement. And I would say, to address Senator Roebling's concerns, we're not in agreement yet. So we do have issues with the policy in the bill, and if we could work out the policy, then we would fully support the emergency rules provision.
Senator Chaudhry, I thought you said that the amendment we adopted with regard to that had been reviewed and worked together with other stakeholders.
It has.
It's just that some don't agree yet. Is that accurate?
I can't remember what Mr. Fisher's group is that he's...
The County Engineers Association.
County Engineers, okay.
Senator Roebling, you have further questions?
Well, I see the township representative standing there, too.
Mr. Sulem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and just very quickly to address Senator Roebling's concern, which I do appreciate members watching out for the impact. Wetland mitigation and road projects are by state law have to be handled through Bowser. And so the only impact that it would have at the township level is if you guys don't fund Bowser enough to continue doing the mitigation credits, there could be issues there. But as long as Bowser is properly funded to do mitigation credits, there is no direct impact at the town road level because it's all mitigated through Bowser.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill on the issues that are germane to this committee?
Have a map to hand out.
Ma'am, you need to sit down and identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and board members, my name is Elizabeth Mursko, and I'm the city administrator for the City of Columbus. And I'm before you today because I'm quite concerned about the administrative impacts and the impacts to the community and landowners of parts of this bill. And so the map that I'm handing out to you shows that Columbus is 65% wetland or open water. And when we make changes to the Wetland Conservation Act, we impact communities that have a higher number of wetlands and open water more than others. And in this particular case, when we decrease the numbers, we obviously will have more applications, more oversight, and I'm the person who will be processing that paper and doing the oversight in at least one of our watershed districts, as we are the local government unit. So I'm quite concerned that we are looking at the exemptions and lowering those standards, as I do understand the intention of the legislation is to narrow the gap in the no net loss policy. But I do think we can look to other avenues to achieve that and not have individual property owners not be allowed to fill, you know, a 10-by-10 area, because that's the new one of the new standards, which is a very small area, in order to build a driveway or have an accessory building or an opportunity to use their property. I won't go any further. I understand that I need to be brief here, and I understand that we can bring it up in other areas, but I felt it important to bring up those issues from a local government perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak with regard to this bill?
That's why I'm asking for it.
Seeing none, Senator Vickerman renews his motion that Senate File 1137, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Ag and Veterans Committee. All those in
favor? Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Given the limited jurisdiction we actually have with this one and some of the concerns I've had, I'd be more comfortable voting for to move the bill out without recommendation. I just don't – there's too many things here.
So are you moving to amend Senator Vickerman's motion?
Without recommendation, yes.
Senator Betzel moves to amend Senator Vickerman's motion that the bill be sent, first of all, without recommendation. Senator Betzel, does that take two motions then, or as an amendment to the motion?
Substitute?
Well.
Two votes?
You do a substitute motion.
Why don't we try it that way?
Okay. So we're just voting on, first of all, changing it to from recommendation to without recommendation, and then we'll vote on the entire motion. All those in favor of sending the bill out without recommendation? We're not voting on the bill yet. Please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have the Vickerman motion as amended before us that Senate File 1137, as amended, be forwarded to the Ag and Veterans Committee without recommendation. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Madam Chair, members.
Chartering.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Quickly, before we, I made a mistake, an erroneous statement in my description of Bill Senate File 1873. I reversed one of the things that the bill intended. I said that this would not require the governor to submit the confirmations. This actually does require, in a second term, the governor to submit that. Please. I just wanted to be clear about that.
And just on that, just for myself then, it's on 1873, the executive orders carry over until the governor leaves office.
For 90 days.
For 90 days, after, and then expire. For confirmations for a governor that is, who is most commonly re-elected, those confirmations need to be resubmitted.
And this doesn't apply to the current term of office because that's already been done. This all right. Be perspective. So.
Okay. We have one of my bills here. I'm going to do it now.
I didn't want to kill a bill. I'm just going to go.
Oh, he'll get it. Take up Senate File 981.
Well, that's fine.
For impacts on road construction.
He said it had 3-4 places. I'll send it there.
I don't think we did this yet.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a bill that we have seen before. We discovered when the bill was up on general orders today that somewhere between the committee hearing and the engrossment that went to the floor, that the amendment that we had adopted in the committee had not been included in the committee report. So we're back here. So we took it off the floor, off of general orders, to bring it back here. And to add that amendment that was inadvertently lost its way, and then to send the bill back to the floor. So, Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment, and what this amendment is part of the bill that we had itself adopted before regarding the responsibilities of the oversight of Met Council returning to the legislature rather than to the commission. So I would move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any discussion of this motion? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
So then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 981 as amended be recommended to pass.
Is there any discussion of that motion? Anyone from the audience care to speak either for or against it? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves Senate File 981 be recommended to pass
as
again.
Amended.
As amended. Be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Senator Marty brings us Senate File 102.
Sure, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Marty.
Senate File 102 is a bill that is in this committee because it takes an existing Legislative Commission on Health Care Access and expands its membership from 5 members of the Senate and the House to 10. And the reason for that is that this bill and some others are giving them responsibilities. The commission has been fairly inactive in recent years, and the legislature is looking at a number of proposals to expand health care, make universal health care coverage. And I believe that the reason for suggesting an increased number is that there are so many members, including some new ones, who have some personal expertise in health care, and a lot of perspectives I think would be very valuable. So I think this is a reasonable number to move to. Not locked in at 10, but I think it's good to expand the size of it some. And so that's the issue before the committee, and happy to stand for questions.
Are there questions for Senator Marty on this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Marty would be very disappointed if I didn't point out that Section 1 of the bill, legislative findings, which we typically don't do, and take up 2.5 pages of the bill. I think would not be in statute anyway.
Session law.
It'd be session. So I moved to strike Section 1 because it doesn't add anything to bill and actually makes it a much better bill, I think.
Madam Chair, I'm not surprised Senator Betzel would offer that. Senator Fischbach has been doing that to all the bills in our committee, and I was surprised she missed this one.
She missed it. We'll help section. Her.
I understand and don't object to the amendment today.
Senator Betzel moves to strike, delete Section 1 legislative findings. So now we have... The bill is before us because there is a commission. And this is a commission that is already in existence. And you are increasing it to 10 members. This commission came into being...
Madam Chair, I think it was 1992.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest that we really should look at the guidelines for commissions again because and you need an amendment.
Yeah. Madam Chair, the one issue that occurred to me when looking at your guidelines was the I assume it doesn't change much here, but the 5-10 members of the House are appointed under the rules of the House, and I think we've been doing it under the Speaker of the House, but I presume that's what the rules would bring it to anyway. But.
Well, and in the Senate, since this is a long-term group, we would want it to say appointed by the Subcommittee on Committees.
Madam Chair, I'll move that... Both that change and the one and appointed by the Speaker of the House.
Okay, so Senator Marty moves on line 321, appointed, after the word appointed, by the Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee of Rules, et cetera.
Senate Committee of Rules on Rules and Administration.
Yes, mm-hmm. And then on line 3.22, to delete under the rules of the House of Representatives on line 323 and say appointed by the Speaker of the House. Senator Marty, is there any currently the members of the Legislative Commission, are they representative by the minority party?
Madam Chair, yes, as you can see. I would not have specified that in here particularly, but this already had it specified in law, so I was, as I was upping the numbers, I...
Where is it
specified? The 323. 324.
I see. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't read further. What we've been doing there for the House, Senator Marty, on the long-term appointment of minority members is giving those appointments to the minority leader. In the Senate, since the Subcommittee on Committees has representation from the minority party, we have said that the Subcommittee on Committees would do the appointment of both the majority members and the minority members. So...
Madam Chair, that's reasonable.
Need to find a way.
Right.
Of
maybe Mr. Bodern can.
Mr. Bodern, we need an amendment that would say that the minority members in the House would be appointed by the minority leader.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, while that's being worked on, I had two questions. Who's going to chair this commission? Is that somewhere else in the statute?
Madam Chair, no, Senator Pappas, no, that's not. And again, the way it's traditionally worked, I believe, has been the health care committee chairs have been the chairs of it. I was just appointed to another joint commission and was just talking to Mr. Hubinger earlier about who brings it, who convenes the first time, the House or Senate chair. And
since it is a newly constituted
group,
Senator Marty, I think there are a number of guidelines that have not been addressed here. Senator Marty, we're going to have to meet again. I wonder if, rather than patching this, if we could lay it over and you could work with Mr. Bodern to address the guidelines.
Madam Chair,
and
when I did talk with Mr. Bodern, we didn't know how we deal with two chairs in the House, the Senate, who convenes it and so on. I mean, I don't know how to bring it forward. I'll be glad to lay it over and meet with him about it. But.
Well, there are things like, you know, when you want the members appointed by and under this new group, because it really isn't, it's the same number, but it's a new group. What particularly because you're giving this newly constituted group new responsibilities. So I think it's appropriate to look to the guidelines for the appointment here, and I think it's going to take more than just a couple of minutes to deal with those issues. Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You also should think about who's going to staff this, what are you doing for a budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, Marty? Those are taken care of already. The commission, I believe, does have some statutory funding out of the Health Care Access Fund, and it is staffed by existing legislative staff. Senate Council and Research has traditionally been the...
Do that before you leave. We already did it.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, those issues have been our resolve. Okay. I mean, they're nothing we're changing on most of those. But.
Before we... Council, did we act on Senator Betzel's motion? Okay. We have Senator Betzel's motion to delete Section 1. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
That motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Then, Senator Marty, I'd like to lay the bill over, and we will indeed deal with it, but I think it would take a lot of patchwork, and we don't, and oral amendments, which I'd prefer not to do with that much work.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I wonder if you want to check to see if there's anyone who wanted to testify. So when we bring the bill back, they wouldn't have to come back.
Yes, I will ask about that too. Is there anyone that wishes to testify in support of or in opposition to the general nature of this bill? We will deal with the guidelines, but in a sense, that's what the form of the commission itself. Is what we are dealing with. And I would point out that this is a legislative commission, which means it's a joint commission made up of only legislators, and there is a statute that deals with that as a definition of what a, quote, if you're going to call something a legislative commission, you have to, according to the guidelines, there's a section of statute where that's defined. Otherwise, you can have commissions, but you can't call them legislative commissions unless it's made up of all legislators.
And Madam Chair, this is so. I mean, I think all of the issues, I believe, I mean, like when Senator Pappas mentioned the staffing, the five current members, I believe the subcommittee has already appointed for this year. So I was not worried about that, but yeah, so the issues we'd have yet to resolve would be the by when they have to be appointed, who convenes it first. Can I ask, because I don't remember what we've done in previous commissions for
whether the guidelines?
I have the guidelines right in front of me, yes.
Okay.
And I just was curious
so
how you've preferred to have it.
Beg pardon?
How you've preferred to do it with the appointments of the chair and with the legislative commissions, because I don't recall.
Well, you may want to consider, because it is a legislative commission, jointly, what generally happens with those is that the the chair rotates from biennium to biennium, and you can certainly consider where the chair is this biennium and continue that body as the chair for your expanded group, and then in the next biennium it would revert to the other to the other house. Some commissions allow, like the Legislative Audit Commission, allows the members to choose their own chair, and I think others are legislative commissions are that the chair is designated by the office which he or she holds, like the chair of the health committee, let's say, is in the Senate, is the chair for this biennium, the chair of the health committee in the House is the chair, whoever that may be. So it's by virtue of their office, so it's an ex officio designation of who is the chair, rather than being the chair being appointed by the subcommittee on committees or the Speaker of the House.
So, Madam Chair, I understand. In other words, you don't have a preference in terms of which way for the legislative commissions, whether it's appointed by by statute to say it's the chair of such and such committee. Or you're open to whichever way we...
You might want to look at the statute of it right now, whether it switches back and forth. Mr. Bonner, did you have a suggestion for Senator Marty?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, what you see in the bill is obviously one small, well, it's a short subdivision from Section 62J07, which establishes the commission. I think what we could do with the amendment would be pull up the entire section so you have that before you to see how it's established, and then go through it in view of the guidelines. Perhaps that would be a more thorough approach.
Is that okay, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I mean, the statute itself is very brief as well, but yes, I'm happy to lay that over.
We will lay over Senate File 102 to be brought back at a later date. Now we have Senate File
50, Madam Chair.
Senate File 50.
And, Madam Chair, I do have two handouts. I'd like to have distributed.
Senator Marty, we have a subcommittee report.
Yes.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, I would move the subcommittee report for Senate File 50 be adopted.
Senator Larson moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 50 be adopted. All in favor of that motion?
I want to.
Aye.
What did I just say?
No, yeah, that's right. I have a question on the subcommittee report. Madam Chair.
Yes.
And maybe I don't know whether this was addressed or what needs to be addressed. It says page 1, line 9, delete 2 and insert 1. And I look at the bill, it says 2 years, and it would say 1 year. Is that what was that intended in the subcommittee report? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that was not intended. I noticed that myself as
okay.
Well.
Okay.
We can change that
okay,
right
now. Okay, I just
want
to see
after
the subcommittee report was correct. Okay.
We'll do that in just 1 second.
Okay.
So we're going to adopt, all in favor of adopting the subcommittee report, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails and the subcommittee report is adopted. Senator Marty moves on line 19 to delete years and insert year. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 50 as amended before us. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this isn't a new concept to most members of the committee. This bill has been before the legislature in the past, and as you're having handed out a list from NCSL of other states, it's about 28 other states have a similar what we call revolving door or cooling off period. For people who are leaving public office before they can lobby, this bill affects legislators, constitutional officers, and commissioners, deputy commissioners, and agency heads. And it is now, as has been pointed out, a one-year prohibition on them serving as a lobbyist in Minnesota. The effective date, as you notice, would not cover anyone who is who leaves office, has left office, or leaves office before the bill takes effect. It would be prospective only. But I think this is an important, it's not a critical problem. I mean, it's not like state government comes to a hold because we have people who move from a revolving door. But I know of a case of a state agency where commissioner was regulating certain industries and left there immediately to go to one of those regulated industries and turns around and the connections built up there, the clout. I mean, that individual is then lobbying, in effect, their former employees. Members of the legislature develop, I think we all develop friendships and connections while we're in office. And yes, those don't disappear in 1 year. I do think it does create a time off. At least we realize somebody's actually left the place before they're back here as a lobbyist. I don't think it's very healthy. I don't consider it to be healthy to just move directly from one to the other. I think a year or two is a reasonable cooling off period. And the point is not that there's something wrong with somebody lobbying. It's the point is that we want to make sure our decisions are based on the merits of the issues. And if a lobbyist has extra access or clout, I think former senators, again, except those who lobby, are allowed on the Senate floor. Most of us continue to call our former colleagues by their title even after they've left office. And I remember one that was a former senator who's been gone for good number of years. It was, I suppose, indirectly Senator Larson's predecessor was testifying before a committee the other day, and I inadvertently called him senator. Not that there's anything wrong in doing it, but again, I think there's a difference when somebody's coming back to lobby. I just think 1 year is a reasonable restriction on when they can come back here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I've got a technical question, Madam Chair, and Senator Marty. You list three different categories, member of the legislature, constitutional officer, or commissioner, deputy commissioner. What happens if, say, a member of the legislature becomes one of the other two? As an example, last year we had two members of the legislature, one from the House, one from the Senate, running for attorney general. It's typical when a governor wants to appoint somebody to be a commissioner of an agency to maybe look to a legislator and appoint that person. So if a member of the legislature becomes, say, the commissioner of, say, human services, is that commissioner barred from lobbying on behalf of that agency because you left the legislature and went straight to be the DHS commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, under 10A, lobbyist is defined. A commissioner would not serve as a lobby, would not be a lobbyist. By definition, I'll defer to Senate counsel if there's any.
What about a deputy commissioner?
Deputy commissioner, not. The state agency employees are not.
Okay.
Are not lobbyists. You have to register with the campaign finance board in order to be a lobbyist, and you are required to if you are. Basically, you're not required to if you're working for a state agency. And I think Senator Gerlach pointed out in subcommittee that if you're not compensated for lobbying, you're not considered a lobbyist either. So if you're doing pro bono work after you leave here, you would not be restricted in this way either.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, and I don't have all the statutes here before me. What was throwing me was it's an individual may not act as a lobbyist. And I think that anybody who comes over here to talk to us and influence legislation is lobbying, whether they're paid for or not. It's different from being a registered lobbyist, and I suppose if you're saying a person that may not be a registered lobbyist within 1 year after filling these positions, but I just... I can need a little maybe counsel. Can.
Madam Chair, I think using the word registered lobbyist is would clarify what Senator Betzel's concern is, I assume.
Maybe Mr. Watson can share what we're pointing to me to, or maybe refer to the part of the statute that defines what lobbyist is, because apparently that is...
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, this bill is adding a section to Chapter 10A.
And in Chapter 10A, there is a section on definitions, 10A01. And there's a definition of the word lobbyist, which says a lobbyist is an individual engaged for pay or other consideration of more than $3,000 from all sources in any year, et cetera. And says, among other things, that an employee of the state, including an employee of any of the public higher education systems, is not a lobbyist. And a public official is not a lobbyist. An elected local official is not a lobbyist. So it goes into some detail on who is and who is not a lobbyist. And it's pretty clear that the
volunteers,
the three people, three groups of people who are listed here, none of them can be a lobbyist by the definition in 10A01 subdivision 21.
And we don't need to make another, we don't need to make a cross-reference to it because this is being put in that same statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A person.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, a person may not be a lobbyist, but may they act as a lobbyist? I don't know. I mean, I was reading the other states, and I just saw the explicit reference to compensation, fee, profession, employment in every other state that had one, and I had concerns along the same lines. I mean, I realize this is a small section pulled out of a broader.
Well, I think they, there has to be something that refers to that definition, lobbyist, to use that word rather than using it as a verb. I see some of these others say may not lobby, but we don't define lobby. We do define lobbyist. So acting as a lobbyist is a way of creating a phrase that's got a verb in it and a noun in it without saying lobby. That's so do lobbying means being a lobbyist, acting as a lobbyist.
I just hate that to be construed too broadly to reach folks just trying to further goals that they personally really believe in.
Well, this is someone who's paid.
Okay.
Is there any discussion or comments to Senator Marty on this bill? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak about this bill, either in support or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator Marty.
I'll move that Senate File 50 be recommended to pass and...
It's as amended?
As amended, excuse me. Be recommended to pass and this goes to any other committee?
I don't believe it needs to.
Then I'll just move that be recommended to pass as amended.
Okay, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 50 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members
Thank you.
Of the committee.
Okay, done.
There being no further, but well, first of all, our next hearing is.
I should ask for a division.
We will not be meeting on Friday, so our next hearing will be on Monday. The House deadline is this Friday. So that will change some of the tenor of our discussion in this committee as we move forward. So there being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.